All right, today's the time set for hearing on docket number 77139, Charles Splon versus State of Nevada. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay. Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Warren Geller, representing the appellant Charles Splon. As this court is aware, there are a litany of issues before that are worthy of the court's consideration. However, I'd like to start out focusing on issue 1A from the opening brief, which is the Batson issue. I'd like to focus on it because there are two separate and distinct structural errors that occurred at that point. The United States Supreme Court has made very clear in JEB versus Alabama that Batson is not limited to racial discrimination during the execution of peremptory strikes, but it also applies to gender discrimination as well. In that case, Justice Blackmun made clear that gender discrimination is particularly acute in cases that involve rape or paternity. This is a sexual assault or a rape case, which makes the issue of gender very, very important. And as you can see from the record below, the defense lodged a timely Batson objection when the state had stricken 5 consecutive male prospective jurors. And then that was renewed once the state got to 9 consecutive male prospective jurors. And during the step one conversation between Ms. Lobo and the district court, there was a discussion about the prima facie showing, at which point in time, the issue was turned over to the state, who started onto step two by explaining what its rationale was for exercising its strikes. And I'm reading the quotation directly from volume 15, page 183, where the state's explanation is as follows. Quote, "We are trying to have a balance here of men and women, and we're still left with less women than men now looking at the numbers." And so I think the fact that they kicked the 2 female jurors at first, that's kind of what we're left with, and we're trying to make up a balance for this jury with these charges in this case. So put in other words, what the state advised the court was they were specifically striking males from the jury for the expressed purpose of achieving a gender balance. Now, there is a mechanism available to either party to attempt to achieve a gender balance when there is a lopsided veneer. When the veneer enters the courtroom, the district court always gives the parties an opportunity to look at the veneer as a whole and make an objection regarding whether or not it is a fair cross-section of the community. The state had the option to do that. They did not exercise that option, and so they were left with the veneer as it was. But then, as I articulated, the state decided to use its peremptory challenges and strikes as a basis for evening out the balance. The court is very clear in Kaczmarek versus State that when a prosecutor or any litigant for that matter jumps in and starts offering its reasons for a strike, we are now on step two of the Batson analysis. Once the court is in step two of the Batson analysis, it is incumbent on the district court or the trial court to then move on to step three and do a weighing between the prima facie showing by the defense and the purported explanation for the strikes by the state. The court elected not to do that in this case, and that is structural error. For this reason is why I say that there are two separate and distinct structural errors that occurred during the voir dire process. The first was when the state openly confessed to intentionally striking males to achieve something close to a gender balance on the jury, and the second was when the district court elected not to weigh the reasons proffered by the state against the prima facie showing offered by the defense, which is required as part of step three of the Batson case. Now, I anticipate that what may happen is the government may retroactively come up with new reasons on appeal why those strikes were issued. However, the United States Supreme Court is very clear that that is prohibited. In the case of Miller L. Stretke from 2005, the court made very clear that on appeal or on remand after an appeal at an evidentiary hearing, the government or an appellate court cannot imagine reasons for why a strike may have happened. So if what we hear today is, well, the strike was for reasons B, C, D, and E, those reasons aren't reflected in the record below, and therefore this court should not give them any credibility or credence. I'd like to now move on to what's identified as Section 2E in the opening brief. This section deals with the pregnancy allegation. The defense filed a pretrial motion in limine seeking to admit evidence that SC, the accuser in the case, alleged that Charles Splon got her pregnant. Now, there was an evidentiary held before the court, and there was a litany of evidence offered to substantiate that claim. For instance, in Volume 7, at pages 6 through 11, a sworn witness, the aunt of SC, Betty Finley, testified that she overheard her directly make that allegation. We had an email from CPS investigator Lizette Woods to LVMPD Detective Donald Cullison. That's at 31AA82. And in Woods' email, she writes to Detective Cullison, quote, initially she, meaning SC, told me she thought he was the father. We also have another reference. It's going to be at Volume 7, page 48. This involves Stacy Roman, who contemporaneously takes notes for CPS when she's on the phone with a Metro officer who's talking with SC. And Stacy Roman wrote a note that, quote, SC stated to police that Chuck, the natural mother's boyfriend, is in fact the father of her child. So what happened at the court...
Mr. Geller, sorry, yes. This is Justice Kadish High in Las Vegas. As far as that goes, the court is charged when this type of issue is raised, when the assertion is that the alleged victim in this case has previously made a false allegation. I think that's where you're going. It's a part of the test that the court is charged with evaluating is whether, in fact, she previously made a false allegation. And here, the court, after that evidentiary hearing, found that, in fact, she had not. And I know you're raising some of the evidence that was brought in, but I read some of that transcript. There were questions about who she had ever actually said that to. It seems like it was a game of telephone where people kept writing that, but no one actually heard it from her in person. So I guess the short question is, wasn't it the district court's job to evaluate that and decide if, in fact, she made a false allegation before?
Well, Your Honor, you are correct. This is subject to an abuse of discretion standard with respect to the factual findings. Now, I am asserting that we do have a question of mixed law, constitutional law, and fact for appellate review. But yes, factual findings are subject to abuse of discretion. And the appellant is alleging abuse of discretion when you have a sworn witness testify that she overheard it. But there's something more, Your Honor. Once the state was able to get the district court to restrain the defendant from offering any evidence that SC ever accused him of getting her pregnant, then the state unloaded on the defense and started offering evidence that she was, in fact, impregnated. They didn't say by whom, but at the time of her impregnation, she was 14 years old. So the state offered this both through SC herself and through her mother, Regina McKenzie. So we have a 14-year-old girl at the time where there's allegations that Mr. Splon was perpetrating all kinds of sexual misdeeds on her. And at this time she gets pregnant, it lends itself to the obvious implication that he was the source of that pregnancy. When in truth, in fact, we had a paternity test, and it's in the record below, that actually exculpated him, and he was not, in fact, the father of that baby. So it's abuse of discretion at the first point. And secondly, the state opened the door to that when they voluntarily offered that into the record. What was so curious about this is in during pretrial litigation, the state was adamant that there should be no reference to her pregnancy on the record because it would soil a reputation or get into issues that might confuse the jury. But then once the defense was restrained from mentioning that Mr. Splon was not the father, that's when the state unloads and starts dumping references all throughout the record that she was in fact pregnant at the same time that she cohabitated with Mr. Splon. I want to move on to the next issue, which is the exclusion of Detective Cullison. That is 3 in the opening brief. Mr. Splon sought to offer evidence that he cooperated with law enforcement. Specifically, Detective Cullison, when he was investigating the allegations, contacted Mr. Splon, and Mr. Splon then had someone drive him down to the police station where he gave a voluntarily 55-minute interview with Detective Cullison. And this was relevant for a number of reasons, but one of which was to show that Mr. Splawn was cooperating with law enforcement and he was not running for these allegations.
Mr. Geller?
Yes.
Sorry, interrupting again. So it's my understanding, though, that that interview wasn't with the same detective or even the same agency that was investigating the incidents giving rise to the charges in this case. Instead, it was about the same pregnancy issue you were just talking about. Is that right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. So the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was the investigating agency relevant to the SC allegations. And then the North Las Vegas Police Department, rather, was investigating the GM allegations. So the Metro Police was where Mr. Splawn drove down and gave an interview with Detective Cullison. Now, the state elected not to file a motion in limine to exclude Detective Cullison. Rather, what they did is after they noticed him as a witness and the defense noticed him as a witness, on the fifth day of trial, outside the presence, they made an oral motion in violation of EDCR rules asking that he be excluded as a witness in the case. And it seemed to be based on an unsworn statement by the prosecutor that he had a phone call with the detective, and the detective had nothing relevant to offer. And so the court ultimately decided that, based on the fact that the prosecutor alleged that the detective had nothing relevant to offer, the defense was not allowed to call this detective. And then the judge issued a flight instruction, which suggested that Mr. Splawn was in fact running away from law enforcement in this case, or running away from the allegations against him. So the defense was not able to present evidence of how cooperative Mr. Splawn was, but the state was able to get a flight instruction. Your Honor, as I see that I have 3 minutes and 50 seconds left, I didn't know if that was relating to my argument or if I need to reserve for rebuttal.
Yes, you're chewing into your rebuttal time now. So
okay.
You've got 300 or
with
3
that, minutes. With that, I reserve the last three.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
All right.
I reserve the last 334 rebuttals.
Certainly. Mr. Sweeten?
Thank you. It's James Sweeten representing the respondent in this matter. And I wanted to start, if I could, by talking about the Batson challenge. You know, now I would note in this case that after all the challenges for cause were disposed of, the remaining jury panel before preemptory challenges were exercised consisted of 23 men, or about 63% of the panel, or about 13 women, or about 37% of the panel. Now, I would note that, and the court noted, the Clark County's population of women is about 51%, so the females clearly were underrepresented from a community perspective on that jury panel, and this resulted in many more men than women on the panel. And the amount of women on the jury was further reduced by the defendants exercised about 5 of their preemptory challenges on those women, leaving essentially 8 women on that jury. So in this case, the state did exercise 9 of its 10 preemptory challenges on men. The defendant made a gender-based Batson challenge, and the state submits that the court properly denied the challenge as not making that first step, the Perkett decision, showing of making out a prima case for discrimination. The law is clear that to make that showing, the defendant would have to show that the totality of relevant facts gives rise to an inference of discriminatory purpose. Now, in attempting to satisfy the first prong, the appellant really did nothing more than present really the number of preemptory challenges exercised against men by the state. You know, in fact, defense counsel, in commenting on the strikes made on men by the state, stated, and I quote, "It appears that they, the state, were purposely taking out each and every man that had a good rapport with us, the defense, on the panel." Clearly, a gender-neutral reason for the state's challenges, even recognized by the defense.
But Mr. Sweeten, may I ask you a question at that point?
Certainly.
You're contending that the first prong was never satisfied, but yet the state jumped in and gave a reason that they were trying to balance this jury. How does that play into our analysis of this?
I would dispute that completely.
Okay.
At all times in the course of this conversation with the court as to this Batson challenge, we are in that first prong. I would note that the portion of the transcript that's referenced by defense counsel, where he's talking about, well, the state made this statement, that's couched completely in a discussion of the Watson decision. specifically, the state is laying out that in the Watson decision, it specifically says that just the number of preemptory challenges all on its own really doesn't have any reason. You have to put it in perspective with other basically measurements. And in that particular case, it made reference specifically to the end result of the jury, how the jury was made up. And it was in that discussion of talking about, at the end, the jury is balanced, that all of that was said. And, you know, if you look at the context of the transcript, that's very clear, because everybody, the defense, the state, and the court, were all on the same page on this. They're talking
with Mr. Sweetin?
Yes.
Hi, this is Justice Kadish. So when, I don't know if it was you or your co-counsel who made the statements, but when you said, we are trying to have a balance here of men and women, and said, we're trying to make up a balance for this jury, it wasn't saying we struck some men because we needed to have less men on the jury?
It was not. And
What did it mean then exactly?
Yeah. It was talking specifically about the Watson decision, because if you look at the substance...
You were talking about what you did in this case.
We were talking about the Watson decision and its application to this case, is what we were doing. If you look at the context that it's in, we were discussing that first prong at all times, and we're detailing out in the Watson decision, we talk about this metric of the end result, and that's what the court is getting to. And after that is said, the court, without beating a skip, jumps right to and says, well, that's correct. And on this particular jury, and it goes through the Watson decision just following up, and defense counsel follows with that as well. There was never any discussion of moving beyond that first prong.
Then let's talk about the Watson decision. And the Watson decision talks about looking at the one way of analyzing the prima facie case is looking at the percentage of strikes as to the particular group at issue and comparing that to the percentage of the veneer. And that case made it clear it's not just the percent of strikes. You have to look at that to compare it and have it be meaningful. So as you said, after all cause challenges, men were making up 63% of the remaining jurors who are now subject to peremptory challenges. And the state used 90% of its peremptory challenges as to men, correct? Even I can do that math, 9 out of 10, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So as opposed to 63% of men in the pool, you used 90% of the challenges as to men.
Correct.
Isn't that a sufficient prima facie showing to go to the next step?
The state would submit no, and the state would submit, and its reading of the Watson decision was essentially that the Watson decision says you need to look at the various metrics in order to make a determination whether or not that number of the actual rate, whether they're men or women on the strikes themselves, has any real reliability in the case. And in this particular case, the state would submit that if you put everything together and you look at the end, there was a fair jury that was picked ultimately. Now, I would note that the court was very clear in laying out the parameters, essentially, that there's a totality of relevant facts. You know, it's my personal opinion that the judge should be given great discretion. I mean, the judge knows what's going on in the court. Everybody, the attorneys, the judge, they know what's going on in the courtroom, and they're able to best make that determination. I don't think that tying a judge's hands by saying, well, just because there's this one metric that is reached, that you cannot make it, you have to make this determination. I don't think that's appropriate. And especially
if a prima facie case were made, then the court would be required to discuss steps 2 and step 3, and that never happened here, correct?
That didn't happen, but again, getting back to the totality of circumstances, there's a lot of other things here as well. Certainly, if there's a situation where there's other indications that the party is actually discriminating against that group, then maybe that raises the issue of just the pure number to a different level. You know, here that didn't occur. As a matter of fact, in our case, it's quite the opposite. Even the defense was essentially laying out the reasons why, in fact, the state made the strikes that it did. You know, what we're really getting to here is, essentially, trying to determine whether or not a particular group has been excluded from the jury. I mean, that's what we're really trying to get to here.
I just want to make sure I understand the process this judge was using, and I'll go back to the transcript, but if you can help me out.
Certainly.
Because you're talking about how many peremptory challenges the defense used as well, which they used apparently 5 against men, 5 against women. But were the peremptory challenges alternating? In other words, were you going back and forth? So state did the first challenge, then defense, then state, then defense, once you got past the cause?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the state's position clearly is that in this particular case, the numbers themselves were not sufficient to reach that first element. The jury itself, as the Watson Court has indicated, there's other tenets that basically give guidance as to the significance, that it's possible that in a case where there's a small number of that particular group in the end, that those strikes that are made are very, very onerous. But in a case where there's a larger number, it might be non-consequential. I also wanted to talk in regards to defense counsel's reference to the pregnancy allegations. And I would note that the court denied defendant getting into any of the any sort of evidence in regards to any sort of statement that allegedly our victim might have made, SC might have made, in regards to the pregnancy of the child. First of all, it wasn't relevant, and that clearly did not come in. The defense sought to admit that as a prior false allegation, and the court had an extensive evidentiary hearing on this, where there was a plethora of witnesses that were called, and the court was able to basically listen to those witnesses and make a determination in regards to whether the evidence would come in or not. Defendant contends that the evidence was sufficient to show that SC made these false allegations that appellant was the father of the child. The court disagreed after listening to all this evidence and found that the defendant had not met that burden by a preponderance of the evidence. Lizette Wood testified that she had contact with SC just a few days after that she went to the hospital, and was very clear that she immediately says no, that this did not happen. There's reference to an email that was made. In that email, she never says that SC told her that this happened. She indicated, I believe in the email, the substance of it was that when she first determined it, she thought through her own mind, was it him or not, and determined that it was not him. But she never said that it was, in fact, him. There was no direct evidence that was ever shown that anyone actually heard SC say that she was impregnated by the defendant. And the court concluded that the situation was probably, as I think the Justice previously indicated, a situation where there was some information, different information, and people just surmised different things. Now, I would note that defense counsel brings up Betty Finley, the state would submit that the court recognized that Betty Finley's testimony was completely unreliable. There's a number of reasons for that. First of all, it made no sense. She describes sitting at a kitchen table one day and SC being in the other room, and all of a sudden SC sort of blurts out that the paternity, and that's it. It sort of just made no sense. She indicated that the statements occurred while Finley indicated that she did not have a relationship with SC, essentially, that she was closer to the appellant.
Mr. Sweeten?
Yes.
Then what I want to jump to on this issue is what Mr. Geller said then. He said that, okay, so the court precluded them from bringing this up as a false allegation, but that the state brought in the pregnancy, sort of leaving the inference that, in fact, he did impregnate her. What about that?
So there was never an inference of that sort. There was testimony in regards to the pregnancy, and that was brought in by, I believe, SC and her mother. And the only purpose that it was brought in for was they were trying to determine the specific date. Remember, there was a big time lag between the disclosure of SC and then ultimately the prosecution of the case. They were trying to relate back the date that SC went to the hospital and made that allegation. And they were able to do that by indicating that SC's child was born on such and such date, and it happened just a few months from there. It was clear, though, from the testimony that was had in the case, that the last incident of any sort of sexual contact with the perpetrator was long before he could have ever been the father. So there was never that implication, the state would submit, that there was, that he was the father in this case. And the state would submit that there was no prejudice in that regard. You know, I wanted to get to this last issue in regards to Detective Cullison. And I first note that in the course of the pretrial motions in this case, that the court ruled that the evidence related to Essie's pregnancy was not going to come in, obviously. Now, at trial, the state became aware that appellant intended to call Detective Cullison. We found this out, essentially, as we were kind of in jury selection and trying to sort of schedule witnesses. And based upon that, the state believed Detective Cullison's testimony would only relate to things that had been excluded, contacted Detective Cullison, talked to him, reviewed his report, and that was the state's understanding. The state, as a general rule, doesn't go about filing motions in limine to strike witnesses whenever the court makes rulings, essentially, that would make their testimony not applicable in the case. But the state does try to proactively make certain that only appropriate evidence comes in at trial. And unless the state, out of an abundance of caution, basically addressed the court in regards to this testimony of Detective Cullison, made sure that the state's understanding of the ruling was correct. And it was at that time that, the defense contends that the state made an oral motion in limine. If this is considered an oral motion in limine, the state would submit that although defense cites Eastern District Court or 8th Judicial District Court Rule 3.20, that's really not applicable here. In the structure of that rule itself, it indicates that it has applicability only unless it's covered by other rules. And 3.20 clearly lays out that it's within the discretion of the court to hear that oral motion in limine. So if it is considered one, it's not defective. Both the state and appellate counsel talked to Detective Cullison independently. The record's clear on that. And after having the benefit of talking to him and also looking at that report, they were able to tell the court what he was going to testify to. And as a result of that, you know, essentially the court made a ruling that it was not relevant and it was excluded. The state submits that, and it was properly excluded.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sweeten. And Mr. Geller, you've got 3:36 left.